When I was about 8 or 9, I lived in a neighborhood that was chock full of kids. Our ages were fairly close together, and we often gathered in the neighbor's yard at the end of the block. They had a double lot, so they had more room for our games and our activities. Plus, the family that lived there had about 6 kids, so there was always somebody that you could find to play with. Our games went from wild and imaginative plays such as horses or pirates to typical games of kick the can or football or baseball. I liked the imaginative games. I was pretty good at coming up with ideas and suggestions to keep us involved in playing for hours. I was pretty good at kickball and dodgeball as well. But if it came to baseball, my interest would start to wane. For some reason, I stunk at baseball. Looking back now, I think it's because I needed glasses, and I just didn't know it at the time. At least that's what I tell myself now. I could never match up my swing with the ball, and I always struck out. Being in the field was even worse. When I tried to catch the ball, I would usually miss it, and if I did catch it, it would sting my hand so bad I'd drop the ball. In the neighborhood, everybody knew who was good at baseball and who was lousy. And I was lousy. So, I developed a solution. If someone wanted to get a game of baseball going, I would suddenly state that I had to go to the bathroom, and then I would run home. Of course, I wouldn't return. I thought this was brilliant. It saved me the embarrassment of being the last kid picked on the team, since everybody knew that I stank at baseball. And it saved me the ultimate embarrassment of letting down the team with my lousy game. But it also ensured that I never got any better at baseball. I come from a family that likes to be prepared, who likes to do well. My husband still marvels at how my family will know well in advance who's doing what and where we're going whenever we're planning a family event. "You should have known better," was something that I heard in my childhood home a lot. I don't believe that my parents were trying to be negative. I think they really thought that they were trying to teach us to be prepared for any possible outcome. But I also learned that if things didn't go the way that I had planned, that I had failed, and that was a problem. This way of living and planning ahead works most of the time. So ultimately, I was rewarded often enough with positive comments and success, yet it left me with very few tools for how to deal with failure. I learned rather quickly to go towards the things that I was good at and stay away from the things that I wasn't so good at. Looking back now, I see that I was not letting myself develop fully because of my fears of failure. Another way that I think about this is kind of the way that I used to play tennis. I played a lot of tennis when I was young. I never had lessons, but I was okay. I had 3 friends that we would get together and play almost daily during the summers. I had a terrible backhand. But instead of looking at what I was doing wrong with my backhand, I literally ran around it. Literally. I would run around the court trying to limit the use of my backhand. This lopsided way of playing tennis illustrates the lopsided way that I was living my life because I was afraid to fail. This fear kept me from looking inwardly at myself, at my true self, and I was stunting my own growth and limiting my own potential. People grow through allowing themselves to fail. We get very little wisdom from success. Wisdom is ultimately gained when we have come through failure and sat with it instead of running around it. Yet our culture supports this way of avoiding failure in the way that we demand perfection from businesses and products and services and leaders around us. If something goes wrong, we want someone to blame. We want someone to take responsibility and pay for those mistakes. A major failure can destroy a business, quickly end loyalty and end friendships. "They should have known better," we tell ourselves, and we immediately run and turn our backs to find the next successful thing. And yet, intuitively, we know that creativity blossoms when we allow ourselves to make mistakes. In fact, the greatest mistake that we can make in life is to be afraid that we'll make one. Our understanding of learnings and the creative process are directly in contradiction to the high standards of perfection that we demand as a culture. This is another example of this lopsided way in which we embrace failure and success in our culture. I had the great pleasure of hearing Parker Palmer speak at Lawrence University last week. Palmer is an educator and an author who encourages us to look at the whole person as we teach and go through the learning process. His talk was entitled, Five Habits of the Heart That Make Democracy Possible. Palmer believes that the heart is where everything begins. The heart is where we learn as children about love, acceptance, honesty, and justice from our dealings first with our parents and then siblings, teachers, and friends. These experiences are deeply ingrained, and they affect our ways of seeing and being and responding to the world around us. They influence our development of meaning and purpose in life. Due to disappointment, failure, and loss, Palmer feels that all of us experience broken hearts at some point in our lives. He believes that our life experiences can either harden or soften our hearts and how we respond to those heartaches. He felt due to our history and experiences that some folks develop brittle hearts. When faced with difficulties, these folks experience their hearts to feel like they almost shatter, sending splinters and shards out into the world, causing damage to others and to themselves. Folks who've had more support in their lives can go through similar heartbreaks, but instead of causing damage, they have what Palmer calls a supple heart. Instead of shattering, these hearts break open. These folks feel safe enough within their communities and their families and self to be able to look inward and learn from their failures and losses and see the value of those experiences. The wisdom to learn from failure is incontrovertible, yet folks who do it well are pretty rare. Failure and fault are virtually inseparable for most folks. Every child learns at some point that admitting to failure means taking the blame, something we find difficult to do. Our culture attaches great shame to this act, and we see many adults model ways in which to avoid taking blame on a regular basis. Reality TV seems to be full of this kind of behavior, where people's lives fall apart, and then they turn and point a finger at someone else. We hear coworkers and bosses, politicians, and even ourselves reach for anything to blame for the cause of failure, except for admitting what is most likely true. I made a mistake. Amy Edmondson, a professor at Harvard School of Business, tells us that in the business world, we struggle with creating safe places in which we can admit and report failure without creating an environment where there's an anything-goes attitude. How can we feel safe to admit failures within an environment that seeks such high standards of behavior? Parker Palmer feels that we need to begin this work at an early age, and I believe he's right. It is something that we often fail to do as parents and as educators in our schools and even here in our churches. Bridget confessed to me that as she was looking for a children's book that dealt with how to handle failure, she came up with practically nothing. What does this say about the way that we teach our children about failure? How can we help our children feel safe and unashamed about failure and yet still feel responsible for learning to move forward from it? Palmer lifted up some habits that surprisingly seem to me anyway to come almost from our Unitarian Universalist principles. He believes that we need to create in children an understanding that we're all in this together. I see that as a direct relationship to our seventh principle of recognizing the interconnected web of life. My actions influence your actions, and so I must be accountable and I'm responsible for what I do with honesty and integrity. not just to you, but to myself and to the world around me. Palmer calls us to cultivate an understanding of the value of otherness, or the inherent worth and dignity of every individual. We grow from stepping outside of our tribes, and that us and them does not mean us versus them. I thought these words were particularly important for us who believe in a liberal faith as we consider our neighbors who might hold more conservative beliefs. It truly is not us versus them, although our culture loves to embrace this kind of drama. If we're going to be successful in creating a world with justice and peace, we must realize that it is us and them together. This is how a supple heart opens up. By opening up, we create the ability or habits to hold tension in life-giving ways instead of life-limiting ways. When we open ourselves up to new ways of understanding ourselves and our world, we create pathways of life enhancement, not just for ourselves, but for everyone. We are able to do this if we feel safe to develop a sense of personal voice and agency. And we're able to seek our version of truth while checking it and correcting it against the truths of others around us. Again, an echo of our UU principle, encouraging the responsible search for truth and meaning. What a delight to see our UU principles literally as tools that we can use to grow supple hearts within ourselves and others. By letting ourselves open up to each other and to experiences, we allow one another to be truly whole, and we can become our best selves. And yet, often fear steps in and muddies the water. Violinist Joshua Bell shared what he called his favorite mistake. He was about 12 years old, and he was entering into a major violin competition. Almost everyone else was college age, and he didn't really expect himself to do very well. The piece he was playing had a very difficult opening, and as he began to play, he messed up worse than he could ever have imagined. He had never made such a terrible mistake before. His parents had come a long way to see him perform, and it was a completely embarrassing way to start. No one had told him what to do when you completely flop at the beginning of your performance. His teachers had never given him any tools, and he didn't know the etiquette. But he thinks what he did was the right thing in the moment. He stopped, and he turned to the audience, and he said, "I'd really like to start again." He felt like he had already lost the competition and had a chance to do well, but he wanted to try again. It could have been his worst performance because his confidence was already low. But somehow, knowing that he had nothing to lose, turned it in the other direction. He got into this zone of feeling completely liberated and relaxed because he felt he had already lost. He feels even to this day that he played the best he has ever played in his life during that moment. The experience taught him that when you take your mind off of worrying about being perfect, sometimes amazing things can happen. Failure can be a teacher. Failure can be a window of opportunity for change, for learning, and deeper reflection. Failure is a place of transition. And it's up to us to decide which way we'll move in response to failure. In this place of tension, will we revert to old habits, avoid it, maybe run home because you have to go to the bathroom? Or could you pause and see the experience for what it is? And let it transform you into something new. Buddhist teacher Pema Chodron says that when we feel that squeeze, that uncomfortable place of embarrassment or feelings of failure, our tendency is to give up, to run away, take a pill, have a drink, or check out in front of a screen somewhere. We may feel like what we were standing on is no longer supporting us. This is a really uncomfortable place to be. We don't feel in charge. We feel pathetic and hopeless. So it's easier to escape that feeling than to pause and sit with it. And yet children invite us to stop and consider this feeling as a stroke of luck. When we're in that place of transition and we feel that squeeze of failure, we can choose to move towards what we think is security, clinging to old habits of denial and blame that keep us from looking inward. Or we can let ourselves feel exposed, as if we have just been born into a new reality. What would happen if we encouraged ourselves and one another to be inquisitive in this new territory? What if we make of our lives a study, like we read in our reading today? What if we take this moment of transition and look within? What might happen if we let ourselves imagine that failure is positive? We need to encourage this kind of thinking because, as Joshua Bell discovered, when we feel we have nothing to lose, amazing things can happen. And I think this kind of thinking is the very thing that Parker Palmer was inviting educators to focus on as they worked with children. This kind of thinking can help us to develop supple hearts, ones that feel safe enough to break open into new understandings instead of shattering into damaging shards. For me, the first step to embracing this way of learning and transition is to get to a place where we're willing to feel what we're actually going through. It starts with being willing to feel compassion to the parts of ourselves that we feel aren't worthy. If we aspire to stay awake and open to what we are feeling and to recognize and acknowledge it as best we can in each moment, then maybe something can change. We might find that we're able to open up instead of shut down. Our old habits and patterns might soften. As we learn to have compassion for ourselves, the circle of compassion for others and what and whom we can work with and how might become wider and more possible. A dear friend of mine gave me a card during a time when I felt like I was a failure. It sits on my kitchen windowsill so I can see it each day. It says, "Life begins at the end of your comfort zone." I can attest that this is true. We can make a choice in each moment. We decide if we'll relate to our circumstances with bitterness or with openness. The key is looking at our habits, particularly the habits of our mind. We create our situation by how we use our mind, by how we keep patterning our response to life. Children tell us that if we refuse to react to situation in our old ways, that this actually causes our thoughts to slow down. And magically, it seems that there's a lot more space to breathe, a lot more room to dance, and ultimately more opportunities for happiness. By opening up a supple heart and expressing compassion for ourselves, we give ourselves room to take a difficult situation and encourage ourselves to leap and step out into that ambiguity. That is why whatever occurs can be regarded as the path, and that all things, not just some things, are workable. This doesn't sound like failure to me. This sounds like opportunity. So I wonder, the next time that you feel you've failed, I invite you to pause, feel the tension and the squeeze, and sit with it. The world will not end. Your heart will not stop beating. And you are just as valued as you were the day before. But now you know something new. Which way will you choose to go? Will you let your heart become brittle and shatter? Or will you pause and allow the moment to be what it is and let a supple heart open into the experience? May it be so.